whole crew of people, including, well, I better not say, because they have to be around Vern a lot more in the next few weeks, but trying to get some funny stuff on Vern. And after I heard all the stuff, I realized that it was not necessary to dig up anything. Any man that will come up on this podium at the Urantia Conference and give a speech on spiritual life that wears patent leather cowboy boots made out of lizards and chicken gizzards speaks for himself. How many do we know across the country that would put the words fog bomb on his license plate? Why did he do this? He couldn't waste a minute. If the gas station attendant that was filling the gas said, "What's fog bomb?" Vern could say, "The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man." We've all watched Vern grow over the years as a public speaker. But I did hear the story that at his wedding, this man that speaks all over the world, when the minister said, "Do you take Nancy Lee to be your wife?" He said, "Yes, I take Lancy Knee to be my wife." Is this true, Vern? But getting more serious, Vern Grimsley has been doing for years what we have all talked about and we all try to do in our own lives, but Vern is taking it very publicly. He has gone out and spread the gospel all over the world. He is what you'd call a spiritual bootlegger of the first class. He has been reading the Urantia book for 25 years. Vern helped co-found the San Francisco Bay Area Urantia Society, has been going to study groups there for many, many years. He is a special representative to the Urantia Foundation in Chicago. He is the president of the Family of God Foundation, director of the Spiritual Renaissance Institute, and they also have the Worldwide Broadcasting Network. They've been teaching the basic spiritual gospel all over the world, and an interesting number, approximately 100 million people worldwide can hear Vern's broadcast throughout the year. That's saying a lot. He has been laying the seeds for this fifth epical revelation, trying to go back and straighten out some of the problems with the fourth epical revelation by teaching the teachings of Jesus on the radio. And the broadcaster throughout Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and now into China. What a fantastic job that Vern and his entire team has done. Vern, you've been an inspiration to us all. We pray for your future work. When we consider that one, get this number, 1/4000th of 1% of the world's population is reading the Urantia book. Did you get that number? 1/4000th of 1% are reading the Urantia book. It is people like Vern that are going to lead the way. And here today to close this conference is a person that has helped so many of us and inspired us, Vern Grimsley.
He just hasn't been able to get the bugs out of this equipment this week. I don't know. Thank you, Mo. A lot of people don't realize Mo Siegel was born one of quadruplets. Unfortunately, his brothers Eenie, Meenie, and Miney were unable to be here with us this afternoon. I once had a vivid dream. I dreamed that I was giving a speech before a large Urantia conference. I woke up, my Lord, I was. Well, it's good to see so many of you here this afternoon. How many of you are here? Hold up your hands. Let me see. Hasn't this been a terrific time? Anybody who hasn't enjoyed this past week is already dead and just doesn't know it. Listen, your Rancher Book students feel better when they feel bad than most people feel when they feel good. Martin Myers told me he'd like to introduce me someday. He'd like to say that listening to me give a speech is like witnessing the launching of a space satellite. He said, first I begin with a roar, then I lose my head and end up in the unknown. Thank you, Martin. The recreation facilities have been wonderful here. I didn't go swimming, though. My suit has a hole in the knee. David Kulicki said that the pool was very crowded yesterday. He said he had to dive in 8 times before he hit water. It's wonderful being here in Colorado. This was originally known as the Wild and Woolly West because the women were wild and the men wore woolies. But now all that's changed. Have you ever seen such fancy clothes the first day here? All the designer jeans, the fancy buckles, the belts, the shirts. I didn't know whether this was a Rancher conference or a Gucci cattle drive. The other day over at the horse riding stables, O'Marion Rally, got on a horse, began to frisk and buck a little bit, and inadvertently got one of its hind hooves caught up in the stirrup of the saddle. Marion looked down the horse and said, listen, if you're getting on, I'm getting off. She later told me she didn't see how anything filled with hay could be so hard. I rode a very polite horse. Every time we came to a fence, he'd stop and let me go over first. If I wanted to go one way, he wanted to go the other way, he'd flip me for it. But everybody's getting into the spirit of the occasion here. Tom and Carol and Kendall were late this afternoon on the way over. They were walking too close together and their spurs locked. You know, Colorado is such a health-conscious place. I don't know. Take, for example, Mo Siegel. Every morning, this man gets up and rides 6 miles on his bicycle at dawn. Some of us think he's a little old to have a paper route, but I say that's his business. And it's such a healthy place here. Some of the people from Los Angeles are getting a little bit nervous, though. They're not used to breathing air they haven't seen. I was talking to one member of the Colorado Society, big, strong, hulking, husky, sturdy fellow. He said, you know, when I first arrived here, he said, I was so weak I couldn't walk across the floor. They had to lift me in and out of bed. I said, that's wonderful. How long have you been here? He said, I was born here. It's interesting. John Hay is kind of bow-legged, and Mo Siegel is knock-kneed. When they stand next to each other, they spell ox. It's wonderful seeing other friends. Last night, the Connecticut Society threw a party out on the lawn. Nick Scalzo was the party they threw out on the lawn. Good seeing Rich Keeler, too. Rich is a casual man. He dresses the way he feels. He hasn't been feeling so well this week, but... Hey, good to see other friends like Jim Jarnigan from Texas. I call him Tex for short. Actually, he's originally from Louisiana, but I'd feel silly calling him Louise. And people like Robert Schur, Roman Catholic priest, reader of the Urantia book, very progressive man, just opened a new drive-in confessional. Calls it Toot and Tell. I found out something I didn't know about John Hales. Told me he used to be a cowboy. I said, did you rustle? He said, only when I wore taffeta shorts. But everybody's getting into the spirit of the occasion. Last night at midnight, Clyde Bedell went out, gargled barbecue sauce, and warbled a Willie Nelson medley outside Berkeley Elliott's window. It was wonderful. But I want you to know that in spite of all the fun we've been having, the Urantia Foundation has not relaxed its vigil of protection of the registered marks, the three concentric circles, and the word Urantia and the copyright. Last night, Tom Kendall, Martin Myers, and I put a dartboard under citizen's arrest in a pizza parlor in Aston. Would you explain that to the last row over there? Oh, it's great being here. Just before I came in here, I was pacing up and down in a room, and a woman came up to me and said, do you get nervous before you're going to give a speech? I said, no, I never get nervous before I'm going to give a speech. She said, then what are you doing in the ladies' room? Some time ago, when I was asked to be the final speaker for this conference, I wrote to John Hales, and I told him that my topic was going to be sub-absolute pre-finaliter post-transcendental correlations of the absonite, the finite, and the infinite with transcendental triodities on the third outer space level. John wrote back and said that topic was already taken. He said Dan Massey was covering that the second day. So instead, I'm going to deal not with some of the complicated things, you know, the sorts of things the fundamentalists debate about. I don't want to talk about, you know, what happens when a missionary who's going to heaven is eaten by a cannibal who isn't, or what do you say to an atheist when he sneezes, you know, things like that. I'm not going to deal with that sort of thing, nor am I going to deal with the sort of Urantia book trivia that we sometimes get interested in, like how many Fran Lanks can dance on the head of a Crenal deck, you know. Actually, Christy told me the number one time. I can't remember what it was. Instead, I'm going to deal with our mission and our message. And before I begin to speak in earnest, may we together share another moment of silence to seek the Father's will and wisdom and guidance. Thank you. On page 909, an archangel of Nevadon writes that modern civilization is at a standstill in spiritual development and the safeguarding of the home institution. On page 598, a mighty messenger writes, the quickest way to realize the brotherhood of man on Urantia is to effect a spiritual transformation of present-day humanity. The only technique for accelerating the natural trend of social evolution is that of applying spiritual pressure from above. On page 2093, the midwayers write, the ultimate goal of society's most advanced achievement can never hope to transcend Jesus' brotherhood of men based on the recognition of the fatherhood of God. On page 910, an archangel of Nevadon writes, spiritual idealism is the energy which really uplifts and advances human culture from one level of attainment to another. On page 1041, a Melchizedek of Nevadon writes, and I stress this is to our time, to our people. Melchizedek writes, the hour is striking for presenting to Buddhism, to Christianity, to Hinduism, even to the peoples of all faiths, not the gospel about Jesus, but the living, spiritual reality of the gospel of Jesus. Page 2082, the Midwayers write, a new and fuller revelation of the religion of Jesus is destined to conquer an empire of materialistic secularism, to overthrow a world sway of mechanistic naturalism. Urantia is now quivering, we read, on the very brink of one of its most amazing and enthralling epochs of social readjustment, moral quickening, and spiritual enlightenment. And again on 2082, the Midwayers write to us, to our time, but religion does need new leaders. Spiritual men and women who will dare to depend solely on Jesus and his incomparable teachings. If Christianity persists in neglecting its spiritual mission while it continues to busy itself with social and material problems, the spiritual renaissance must await the coming of these new teachers of Jesus' religion, who will be exclusively devoted to the spiritual regeneration of men. And again, on 1041, Melchizedek writes to us, in the present tense, all Urantia is waiting. Not will be, future. But now is. All Urantia is waiting for the proclamation of the ennobling message of Michael, unencumbered by the accumulated doctrines and dogmas of 19 centuries of contact with the religions of evolutionary origin. And the Urantia book, among the thousands of things it tells us, goes on to say which things are most important. What things in the teaching of this book are top priority. On page 2090, for example, the Midwayers write, that of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Of all human knowledge, that is most important. On 2086, the Midwayers write again to us, the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear. That means even if there's a sixth, a seventh, and an eighth, and a ninth epical revelation, still the greatest truths mortal man can ever hear are the living gospel of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. End of quote. And we are called to be transformed people and herald forth this transforming truth. On 2052, we read, that which the world needs most to know is men are the sons of God, and through faith they can actually realize and daily experience this ennobling truth. We read on page 1806, Jesus and the 12 apostles were encamped at Magadan, and they trained 70 evangelists to preach throughout Galilee, Samaria, and Judea. And we read these evangelists are described as enthusiasts for the gospel of the kingdom. There was a story about an evangelist standing before a huge crowd of people, waving his arms, shouting, screaming, gesturing, gesticulating, everybody being warned to flee from the terrible wrath to come. He said, in that awful day of judgment, there will be weeping, and there will be wailing, and there will be the gnashing of teeth. One little old lady stood up in the back and said, sir, she said, I have no teeth. Madam, this evangelist bellowed, teeth will be provided. That's evangelism as I'd always heard it. But as described in the Urantia book, it's a warm, loving, enthusiastic outreach. It's described as enthusiasm for the gospel of the kingdom, enthusiasm for spiritual truth. On 1593, Jesus says, simply go forth proclaiming, this is the kingdom of heaven. Here's how simple it is. This is the kingdom of heaven. God is your father, and you are his sons, and this good news, if you wholeheartedly believe it, is your eternal salvation. That's simple. On 1805, he says, proclaim a spiritual brotherhood of the sons of God. Page 1931, Jesus says, you're to be valiant in defense of righteousness, mighty in the promulgation of truth, and aggressive in the preaching of this gospel of the kingdom, even to the ends of the earth. On page 2049, he says to the apostles, if you would obey me, go then into the lands of the Gentiles and proclaim this gospel. There's but one law to obey, he says. That is the command to go forth proclaiming. He emphasized outreach, that it's not enough that we enter the kingdom and find this wonderful truth for ourselves, but we have a mission to all of humankind, to this entire globe, to help bring a great spiritual renaissance across this earth. And on page 2043, Jesus says, the Father sent me into the world, so send I you. In 15 out of Jesus' 19 resurrection appearances, he gives the commission to go into all the world, not just talking to apostles, but to believers. go into all the world and proclaim this gospel. 2,000 years later, not even the religion about Jesus has yet been proclaimed globally, much less the real religion of Jesus. A tremendous challenge lies before us. Consider the history of the preceding four epical revelations. Of the first epical revelation, the rebellion marred Dalmatian teachings, we read that it was essentially lost to the world. That's the first one. Of the second epical revelation, the defaulted Edenic mission, we read that by 2500 BC, humankind had largely lost sight of the revelation sponsored in the days of Eden. Of the third epical revelation, Machaventa Melchizedek, we read that the results were, and this is a quote from the book, vague and uncertain. Of the fourth epical revelation, we read that the religion of Jesus became transmuted and diluted into a religion about Jesus, and that, quote, the stream of modern Christianity drains many an ancient swamp and many a barbarian morass. With such a sobering history of distorted, defaulted, and rebellion-torn revelation composing our planetary past, it is all the more important that we take seriously the commission that is given to us to bring a spiritual awakening on our planet in this time. In that beautiful multimedia presentation by Oklahoma last night, remember going through the apostles when they came to Andrew, the apostolic chief? Do you remember in the book they say his greatest single handicap? Do you remember what it was? His lack of enthusiasm. There's an echo in here. His lack of enthusiasm. That's on page 1550. They said that was his biggest single handicap. But one page later, writing of his brother Simon Peter, the midwayers say that he was a great and saving light to thousands who sat in darkness because the fires of the kingdom burned so brightly within his soul. He was enthusiastic for it. And he shared the joy of knowing God and the power that there is in living truth. Consider the reserve corps of destiny for a moment, the sort of leadership kind of commitment the universe can use to optimum. Page 1257, we read of this planetary reserve corps of destiny composed at the time of the writing of the Urantia Book of approximately 1,000 men and women. They say that there are three criteria for entrance into that reserve corps. Over two of these, the individual has no control whatever. Possession of an extraordinary or advanced thought adjuster and capability, secondly, of being secretly rehearsed for function in planetary emergency. But over the third of these criteria for being in the reserve corps of destiny, the individual has complete and utter control. And I quote 1257, wholehearted dedication to some special social, economic, political, spiritual, or other cause, coupled with willingness to serve without human recognition or reward. That's a portrayal of the kind of commitment, wholehearted dedication for whatever God's will for any one of us is to that purpose. And the Father's will for many of us is rearing good families, loving our children. But whatever God's purpose is, wholehearted dedication. And then if we can do it without human recognition or reward as being a motivation, the Father can use that to optimum. For another description, consider Amadon. Page 757, we read that he was the outstanding human hero of the Lucifer Rebellion. And on page 762, we read that for seven long years during that rebellion, from Edentia to Salvington and all the way to Uversa, the first question asked by all subordinate celestial life ever and always was, what about Amadon of Urantia? Does he still stand unmoved? And now, on this sphere of our universe sovereign's final bestowal, a fifth epical revelation has been given. And I have no doubt in my mind whatever that the universe is watching us as well, and asking of you and asking of me, what about us? Do we still stand unmoved? Are they going to pull this off, or are they going to fail as they failed with previous epical revelations? It is a tremendous responsibility and task which has been placed upon us. The gospel according to Matthew chapter 13, on page 1807 in the Urantia book, Jesus says, "But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which you see and have not seen them, and to hear those things which you hear and have not heard them." Thus Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God and the Son of Man, once spoke about himself. And thus now I would speak about the Urantia book. Truly, blessed are our eyes, for they see, and our ears, for they hear. For many prophets and righteous men, saints and sages and seekers for centuries of planetary history have longed and yearned with a burning in their souls to know these very truths of heaven, which now have been given in our time, have been given to us, and what we do with them and how we live by them are matters of high and sacred responsibility. Said Jesus, from those to whom much has been given, much will be required. To us, so much has been given. But of the early apostles, much was required as well. Think again of Andrew. Remember, the midwayers say that he taught spiritual truth and led thousands into the kingdom. And finally, for that, he was put to death. We read it was two full days before the apostle Andrew expired upon the cross, but he continued to teach. Remember the apostle James. Midwayers say that he bore his execution. Again, his crime was following the teachings of Jesus and teaching those. But he bore his execution with such spiritual grace and such love and such power that his very accuser and informer, who had led him to trial, fled from the scene of James' execution and ran to join himself to the disciples of Jesus, saying, "This has to be real. I have to have it too." Remember Andrew's brother Simon Peter. Midwayers say when he was told that for teaching the teachings of Jesus he was to be put to death, he considered himself honored when he was informed by his captors that he was to die as his master had died on the cross. And the same day, the midwayers say that the apostle Peter was put to death, his wife was thrown to the wild beasts in the arena at Rome. We also read that Matthew was killed for teaching the teachings of Jesus in Thrace. And on Malta, Thomas Didymus was executed for teaching the teachings of Jesus. In Hierapolis, Philip the Curious was put to death, and they say that his wife stood there at the foot of his cross. He continued to teach the teachings of Jesus best he could. When his strength began to fail, she began to take up the telling of the story. What a picture that is of commitment. They were willing to live for this, and they were willing to die for this truth, and they were willing to teach it with their dying breath. No wonder the midwayers say these men and women turned the world upside down. But a great mission is before us as well. We look back. Everybody see my coat? Anybody else wants to look at it? It's right up here. We think we look back to those early apostles, to Peter and James and John and Mary Magdalene and the women's corps and the rest. And I've heard people say it so many times, what a time that was to be alive. But then think of this, that long centuries from now, there will be people who are students of this fifth ethical revelation who are going to look back to our time, to our generation, this first generation when the Urantia book was given, and who are going to say of us, what a time that was to be alive. And they'll be right. This is a tremendous pivotal point in planetary history. And we have decisions to make about where we're going to commit our time, our energy, what we're going to do with our lives that'll be consequential. The Urantia movement is not just a club, it's a cause. This is not a Kingdom of God key club where we congratulate ourselves for being possessed of the fifth ethical revelation, like somebody thumbing his nose out the porthole of Noah's Ark. It is not enough that we have discovered it. There's a hungry world out there as well. And our great mission is to be part of a spiritual renaissance which will transform this planet. Let me ask a hypothetical question. but it's intriguing. Suppose there were a great conclave held tonight among all the planetary administrators, and that they decided after much due deliberation that to have given us the Urantia book at this time had simply been a mistake, that we weren't ready for it, clearly and obviously. And suppose that they decided tonight, overnight, to recall the fifth epical revelation. Suppose we woke up tomorrow morning and we didn't have any Urantia books by our beds. And every line we'd ever taken or written down or copied was gone. Everything ever tape recorded, gone. The mysterious vanishing of the plates from the printer's warehouse, the publishers befuddled by what had happened. Suppose the entire Urantia book were taken back tonight at midnight. My question is this: how much of this fifth epical revelation would you and I still yet possess? How much of it have we assimilated? How much is really part of us about the way we live, the way we think and feel and act and react? How much is truly ours? Do we just know about God, or do we really know God? Have we just found out about God, or are we really finding God? Most on-target keynote address I've ever heard was Dave Elder's the first day here saying, our primary task here is to get to know God better, get closer in our spiritual lives. Do we just know about these things, or have we found them ourselves? And are we committed? If we're serious about our commitment to the fifth epical revelation, it is my conviction that we must give to the Urantia Foundation and the Urantia Brotherhood in Chicago our spiritual support, our moral support, our financial support, love them, help them, and work with this future of the fifth epical revelation with commitment and with goodwill. I have an interesting perspective on the passage of time, because in these last 25 years of reading the book, particularly the last 20, I've been asked to do a great many weddings for young students of the Urantia book. Did one just yesterday here at Snowmass for two students of the book. Then I've seen children born. Nancy and I were invited to be present at the birth of little Heather Cantor, David and Sue Cantor's daughter. Magnificent, exquisite experience for us. And I'm the godfather of little Sarah Siegel, daughter of Mo and Peggy Siegel. So I see the children born. Then it's also been my experience being called upon to do memorial services for some of the old Urantia book students when they've died. For example, Russell Buckland wrote material for Dr. Sadler's memorial and did one out in Los Angeles at the International Conference in 73 for Alvin Kulicki when he died as president of the Brotherhood. He was in office when he passed on. The reason I bring this up is that I have this perspective of birth and marriage and death. It goes on, birth and marriage and death. But it all goes by so quickly. Our tenure of time on this whirling planet is so brief. The decisions we make, the commitments we make, where we're going to put our time and our energy, we have just a few alternatives, and suddenly our lives are gone. I've talked to some of the saddest people I've ever met have been old people who, with a misty wistfulness in their eyes, have said, you know, I had, when I was younger, a chance to give myself to something really great, to be part of something, to serve, to make my life really count. And, you know, I just never got around to it. I never quite did it. I didn't mobilize myself. Those are some of the saddest people I've ever met. It is my conviction that coming out of this conference here, there are going to be some people who are remotivated, recommitted, renewed in their dedication to help bring a spiritual awakening upon this planet. Someone may say, well, not much has happened with the Urantia book. Here it is. 26 years ago, this book was published, and what do we see happening with it? Where's the great spiritual explosion, somebody might say? Ah, but consider the first 26 years of Jesus' life. Somebody might say, this is the promised deliverer. He's 26. He's going around doing carpentry work. He's done. When's it going to happen? They might have said, ah, but consider what was to come. Consider what lay ahead. And in the same sense, much lies ahead of this Urantia movement. I believe we need to keep a low publicity profile, but to help people find the book and to find spiritual truth,
But there are tremendously challenging times lying ahead of us. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, God grants to every mind its choice between truth and repose. And we in this tent have chosen truth. Let us forever relinquish our wistful wishing for repose. It shall not be ours. What right do you and I have to hear these truths twice when there are millions on this planet who have not heard them once? There's a mission for us. It must be conducted wisely, but with enthusiasm, with joy, most of all with love. What the Urantia book says about love, all true love is from God. And man receives the divine affection as he himself bestows this love upon his fellows. Love is dynamic, we read. Can never be captured. It is alive, free, thrilling, moving, always moving. Man can never take the love of the Father and imprison it within his heart. The Father's love can become real to mortal man only by passing through that man's personality as he in turn bestows this love upon his fellows. And that kind of love ought to motivate and actuate every one of us who's a student of the Urantia book. After all, Jesus didn't say, by this will all men know that you're my disciples, that you have a concentric circle pin on your shirt. He didn't say, by this will all men know that you're my disciples, that you carry a blue book under your arm. Do you have a membership card in your billfold or your purse? He said, by this will all men know that you're my disciples, that you love one another. We have to be the most caring, loving, sharing, wanting good for each other group of people on this planet. And everybody else is going to say, where in the world did they come from? And what are they reading? I want it too. There's no defense against love, joy, and enthusiasm. You can encounter somebody of some religious philosophy who wants to debate your theology, what you believe, what you think about the afterlife, or any one of countless other topics. But if you are possessed of love, joy, and enthusiasm, everybody wants those things. And those touch people. We ought to be the happiest people on this planet, Urantia book students. One of my favorite places in the entire book is where it tells how Jesus loved his little sister Ruth, and says that he used to go tell stories to the children out by the carpenter's shop, you remember, and there's a great line on that page written by the Midwayers about this. They say, of the little children, they were learning to laugh and to laugh heartily. It's a great sentence because it teaches two things. Number one, it says they were learning to laugh, which suggests to some degree or another that laughter can be learned. To learn a sense of humor, to learn more sense of joy. And secondly, they were learning to laugh heartily. They just didn't enjoy life. They enjoyed it a lot. And we ought to be robust religionists. Anytime I see somebody walking around carrying a Urantia book, looking like he just brushed his teeth with anchovy paste, sucking on a dill pickled dynamint, or a liver-flavored lifesaver, somebody with a sour expression, I figure that person hasn't discovered yet really what the Urantia book's all about, because it's the most resonant, joyous, service-motivated, happy philosophy I've ever encountered. When I was a boy growing up in the flatlands of southwest Kansas, there was only one place I ever heard about where there was not supposed to be any laughing, any joy, any jokes, any humor, any wit, any fun. And ladies and gentlemen, that place was hell. And number one, I don't believe there is any such a place. And number two, I've already made arrangements to be somewhere else, and so have you. We ought to be the most enthusiastic, joyous, fun people to be around, most loving, most sympathetic, most understanding, sharing, caring people on the planet. And people will see it, and they'll want it as well. What a message we have to share. Just this year, I was speaking in Washington for a big banquet of civic leaders. And at the conclusion of it, several hundred people came up and we were talking, and there was a man I saw walking up, holding his left hand out in front of him like this. He was about 50 years old, I would guess, and he had tears in his eyes. And he had in his other hand a ballpoint pen. He came walking up to me and he said, "Vern, there was one thing you said in your talk." He said, "I didn't have a piece of paper to write it down, so I took out my ballpoint pen and I started writing it on the palm of my hand." But he said, "I have to have that exactly the way you said it. It was about how God can use a person's life." So I repeated to him the idea that God is not so concerned about your ability. God is not so concerned about your inability. But God is primarily concerned about your availability. Whether you're really willing to say, "Here am I, send me, use me, whatever awkward talents I have, I want to be part of the kingdom, I want to serve, I want to help this planet grow." The man wrote down in the palm of his hand with that ballpoint pen what I'd said, and he went walking out, and I saw him walking out the exit, and he was still staring at his left hand. What a message we have for this world. What transcendent truth. What a change it can make in people's lives. My wife Nancy and I had the experience for some 10 years of being volunteer supervisors, ward supervisors at Children's Hospital in Oakland, California, one of the great children's hospitals of the United States. And during that period of time there, I met one, many unforgettable young people, but one that indelibly is etched in my memory. His name was Kevin, 12 years old, dying of leukemia, had blood cancer. One of the brightest minds I've ever encountered. And it used to tear me. He'd want to hold my hand sometimes. He'd be going through cramps and contractions from the experimental chemotherapy and from the pain of the disease. But when he could talk, he was full of questions about philosophy and religion in particular. Now, Kevin's parents were divorced, and his custody had been given over to his mother. And none of his family believed in God. None of them believed in life after death. They didn't know what to tell this inquiring, seeking young man. So I began to say what I believed, and finally his mother gave permission for me to go ahead and teach the things I believed because it made such a real difference in his morale and his spirits and his attitude. So I told him the things we learned in the Urantia book. He was too weak to hold the Urantia book and read it, and his mother wasn't interested. I tried introducing her to it. But I told him about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, that we're all one great friendly family, this universe is friendly. Told him that the kingdom of God is within, that a fragment of infinity, a glowing ember of eternity, indwells the mortal mind. I told him that this is only the beginning. God has a plan for this planet and a purpose for human life, endless life. And just as a bee goes from flower to flower gathering nectar, so one day we are destined to voyage from star to star gathering light. And I told him the quest for perfection, and truth and beauty and goodness. And he believed it and he loved it. And I remember one of the last times I saw him, Kevin was lying there in his hospital bed and we were talking and he suddenly said, "Vern, I know I'm going to die. They've told me I'm going to die." But he said, "What will it be like? What do you think?" So I told him again about personality survival, how his real identity would be retained and all this. And he said, "No, that's not what I mean." He interrupted me. He said, "No, that's not what I mean." He said, "What will I get to do?" Here he was, lying on this little bed, you know, and tubes in his arms, and should have been out running and playing with his friends, and his big question was, "What will I get to do?" Well, I prayed for guidance for an answer, and suddenly it came into my mind, he was a great fan of that old, classic television science fiction program, Star Trek. So I said, "Kevin, it's going to be like Star Trek." I said, "There are going to be places to go. You'll go exploring and you'll go learning. The whole universe will be there like a university of things to do, assignments, exploits, things to be undertaken, things God wants you to do. It'll be like Star Trek. It'll be wonderful." And he grinned and his eyes lit up and he said, "I love that." And I could see in his eyes a thousand new thoughts were in his mind. Well, the last time I saw him was over at Stanford University Hospital. He was in intensive care there, and he was too weak and too in pain even to be able to speak, but I could still see in his eyes that new vision of what lay ahead for him. And a few days after that, my phone rang, And it was Kevin's mother, and she called to tell me he was gone. But she said, you know, Vern, right to the very last, he didn't talk about dying anymore. He talked about starting his Star Trek. And somewhere... I think about it somewhere this afternoon. There's a young fellow who knows more about truth and reality and God and the cosmos than any of us here, so wise as we are with our Urantia books. That lad's name is Kevin. I can't wait to see him again. And he found a faith that brought him through. And so may we find such a faith as that and realize that in our great mission, our great Star Trek from here to the center of infinity, our first assignment that we've been given is right here on this planet, Urantia, to bring a great spiritual awakening across this earth. I doubt that the passage of time will ever obliterate from my memory my recollection of H.G. Wells writing in his classic outline of history of the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, writing about the statesmen and the world leaders there assembled. H.G. Wells wrote of them, "These were the men whom God had mocked with the most tremendous opportunity in history." I say this afternoon that opportunity is ours. And we, if we will, can be part of a great religious awakening of love for God and love for humankind on this earth. Somebody may say, well, I don't know what I could do, what part I could be in it. That's like blowing out your candle to see how dark it is. God has a use and a purpose for each one of us. If we will but seek it and dare to do it. I do not believe for a moment that the Urantia movement has a monopoly on God. But I pray with all my being that God may have a monopoly on the Urantia movement. I pray with all my being that we may with one tongue declare it is our will that the Father's will be done. That it not be who's right, but what's right. And that we be activated to serve our fellow human beings and help to bring this great spiritual awakening so urgently needed across this planet. It will be difficult. We've been instructed that. But on page 291, there's something a perfecter of wisdom from Uversa wrote to us. He said, long before reaching Havona, these ascendant children of time have learned to feast upon uncertainty, to fatten upon disappointment, to enthuse over apparent defeat, to invigorate in the presence of difficulties, to exhibit indomitable courage in the face of immensity, and to exercise unconquerable faith when confronted with the challenge of the inexplicable. Long since the battle cry of these pilgrims became in liaison with God, nothing, absolutely nothing, is impossible. What a privilege is ours. What a task has been set before us. And if we are true to our trust and hold aloft a torch of truth and love to this twilight-seeking world, one day the nations shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and the world will not learn the ways of war anymore. And I foresee that one day there shall reign upon this planet a great divine dominion, the brotherhood of all mankind, beneath the sovereign fatherhood of God, such a new age of worldwide goodwill, such a kingdom of kindliness and love, as shall make the mightiest empires of this earth seem frail and foolish in comparison. And then shall the glad tidings echo forth from the peaks of the Rockies to the slopes of the Himalayas, from the velds of Africa to the valleys of Nebraska, from equator to ice cap, from sea to surging sea shall ring the shout, peace on the earth, goodwill to men. God's love knows neither longitude nor latitude. All humanity are brothers, all humanity are one, all humanity are His, and we are called to work to bring that day to be. I thank you.
Vern, you... Hello. This brings us to the close of the formal part of this conference. Vern's talk was great. Thank you, Father, for everything. It's going to be a long 3 years, but this has just been fantastic. God bless you all, and hope to see you all later this afternoon at the barbecue.